Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour. This is for March 5th, 2020. A lot of topics to cover tonight. Should report that in Nashville, of course, this show airs from WWCR, the biggest radio station in the world, and out on the edge of Nashville, up on the hills, are mounted the four huge shortwave towers of WWCR, and they were unscathed with the tornado. So anyway, we're happy to hear also condolences to those people who were affected. Over 20 people dead out apparently in the eastern area outside of Nashville. Also next week, starting next week, my frequency will change. Now this is because my show, for running now for 20 years, has been on the cusp between day and night. And in the winter time, the frequency 5.935 that you're listening to right now, if you're listening to the show live at WWCR, works better in the winter time. And then in the summertime, when it gets light earlier, I'm right at that, 6 p.m. Central Time, right at the cusp of where the when daylight savings time changes, and very close to the time when the springtime changes, the March solstice, or I'm sorry, the equinox. But anyway, next week, my point is that next week my frequency will change to 9.350 megahertz. And so just make a note of that. Starting next week, the 12th of March, my radio show will air on 9.350 megahertz. And this is explained on my webpage also. And this is just flipping between these frequencies. This is due to the FCC. These are FCC rules that the station follows regarding which frequency is better for the show at certain times of year. Okay, just a quick note here. I got an email from a listener. So this is from a listener, from just not qualifying this as it's correct or not. But there's a treatment that they've been using for malaria for forever. It's called chloroquine phosphate. And there are reports that it has been used to some beneficial effect with the novel coronavirus that's going around right now. And I decided also that in terms of discussing this, the coronavirus, since the officialdom is announcing and talking about this, there's really a lot of unanswered questions. Where did this came from? Did somebody drop this in the middle of Wuhan, the industrial area in China? There are only a few entities in the world that have this kind of virus in a bottle, etc. But since no real information is coming out, I'm not going to speculate, or I'm just kind of going to go away from this topic and, let the standard news media cover it. But the one thing that is very clear is that quarantine has worked. Quarantine has worked. And finally, the international medical community is waking up to the fact that I'll be talking about, in fact, the Spanish flu of 1918, where they typically did not quarantine. And it went so quickly through the public that they would quarantine people, and they really didn't have facilities then where they could properly quarantine people. But anyway, excuse me, the real issue here is that Trump slammed the door on flights coming in from China early. If not, this thing would be all over the United States. It would be really bad, and everybody concerned agrees with this. I agree with it fully. But quarantine, and I've been saying this for years, whenever you have anything, whether it's measles or mumps or rubella or whatever it is, these are communicative diseases. These are things that you get from somebody else. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't float through the air. These are viruses that live in the human organism and then are transferred from one person to the other. So, and literally, the way they obliterated measles as something that just doesn't occur in the United States anymore, unless somebody goes to a foreign country and brings it back, it's a worldwide issue, and there is a certain death toll associated with having measles. When I was a kid, I had every kid disease. I had measles, mumps, chicken pox, just go right down the line. All the pox things I had. And as a result, I believe I have a very strong immune system, because you have to build up an immune system that is very, very robust to get through these. And when I was a kid, if somebody had the measles or the mumps or something like that, the parents would get the kids together and they would let them play together until they all got it. And then they all went through it together. And that was the end of it. But the other thing is it builds up your immune system for future life. And the people who did not have those, if they contract it when they're older, have a real rough time. The issue with vaccinations, let me just talk from a statistical point of view. From a statistical point of view, it could be stated, and I have to be very careful when I talk about this thing, but the fact that in the United States, they've actually used quarantine as a mechanism while giving vaccinations. And so if somebody got the measles or mumps, they were quarantined. And so eventually, it's not clear if the vaccination or if quarantine is what has eradicated those so-called childhood diseases. And here's an interesting little twist on this, that if people, if the parents who get vaccinated, of course, this is something that people discuss. This, I'm not the first one to say this. But if vaccinations work, then why should parents worry that if some kid comes to school that's not been vaccinated, that, say, brings in measles, then everybody that's been vaccinated, why would you worry? Your kid's vaccinated. This should be immune to getting measles. But the if you look at the shots and the information that you get when they want to convince you that you're supposed to get your kids vaccinated, it says on there that there can be side effects from the vaccinations up to and including death. In other words, the vaccinations kill kids. The other thing is that they now are claiming that, this is a statement by the people supporting vaccinations, that if you don't have, they call it herd vaccination, in other words, you have to vaccinate everybody for it to work. And what that tells me is they're using quarantine instead of the vaccination, so that if, say, 93% of the population is vaccinated for measles, then if it doesn't work, they say, oh, it's because not everybody was vaccinated. Well, wait, that's backwards. If you have one person that's vaccinated, if the vaccine works, then it doesn't matter if everybody else in the world has measles, for example, and your person who's vaccinated walks amongst all these people that are not vaccinated that have measles, then the person that's vaccinated should not have any problem at all because they're vaccinated. But now they're saying, well, unless a high percentage, up in the 95-plus range percent of people, unless that large number of people are vaccinated, then the shots don't work. So they're giving themselves an out. In other words, what it tells me is they're using quarantine and they're eliminating the presence of, for example, measles or other so-called childhood diseases. They're eliminating these because of quarantine, not because of vaccination. And so anyway, that when you can't get near these people to have an intelligent conversation because they publish in their respectable peer-reviewed medical journals. They stick together. They get the medical community gets the majority of their money from pharmaceutical companies. And so this is, you know, you can't go into Target or Walmart without somebody trying to stick a needle in you. And this is one of the fears also of a lot of people, that if somebody comes up with a vaccination for the so-called novel coronavirus, then are they going to make everybody take this? Well, if you don't take the shot, you're banned from any public gatherings. You know, and the other thing is, with vaccinations that were developed, for example, for SARS, the predecessor virus, the thing that the current novel coronavirus was mutated from, SARS, they developed a vaccine, and when they gave people the shot, if they had a recurrence, they had 100% death rate from people who got the vaccine. And so you're not going to know that until you give the vaccine to a lot of people and they start getting recurrences, relapses, and then they end up dying. So at any rate, this is a very touchy set of issues. And anyway, what's clear also is you're getting a lot of fear porn coming out of all different places. But from people who really don't have information, they don't have clinical information. And the people that do have clinical information, let's put it this way, not many people trust them. I'm not weighing on either side of that coin myself, but not a lot of people trust the medical industry. So anyway,
just a quick comment that the government passed some legislation for moving into supporting alternative energy, etc. And so they included nuclear. So now the trend, and I've talked about this before, that the trend is for to call nuclear green because it doesn't emit carbon dioxide. But wait a minute, Sam. The not emitting CO2 is the least of the problems with nuclear. Emitting horrifically disastrous, poisonous radioactivity is a problem. I mean, look at Fukushima. Is that green? They're saying Fukushima is green. Let's take a serious look at this. The explosion that caused tremendous radiation leaks into the Pacific Ocean and blew up and evaporated 600,000 spent fuel rods on the roofs that they were using in the cooling towers, on the roofs of these units, that's green, according to this logic. That was green because it didn't emit carbon dioxide. So Fukushima is green, according to nuclear experts. Excuse me. Wow, it just doesn't get any loonier than this. But they're trying to maintain nuclear. But let me be very honest about nuclear. The United States has 104 nuclear power plants. Most of them are very near the end of their life cycle. They've been extended far beyond their license, their certified lifetime. They're burning high-octane fuel in these that was never meant to be burned in them, and the vast majority are leaking. They have no way of testing the piping, and they don't have money to decommission these. Nuclear only every year provides less and less of our total electrical energy consumption. And so it's less than right now, about 15% or less. So nuclear is not a solution that's going to work for the United States. Natural gas is a solution, but it's short term because fracking is pounding that natural gas out of the ground right now. And but it's not going to last. Fracking is something that's going to go the way of the dinosaur, possibly in a few years. And then we're going to be stuck because they shut down all the coal plants and are depending on natural gas. And also they're selling our natural gas off to foreign countries, liquid natural gas.
and to foreign countries like China. We're selling huge amounts of it. So that's good in the short term, but long term, it's not good planning. Okay, just a quick note on the stock market. I'm not a financial expert, but it doesn't take a stock market Wall Street genius to figure out that this sell-off that occurred for about a week was planned. The big boys were doing it. And then at the end of that week, come Monday morning, this past Monday morning, everybody went in and bought. So just imagine there was about a couple trillion dollars won by a very few people, divided up because of a rapid sell-off and then returning to the to purchase those stocks back at the same price. And that's what the surge was start Monday. So all of that money went into the pockets of a few people. Just a quick comment. This is related to the novel coronavirus and reaction, etc. I can tell you, I have investigated myself. The factories in China are operating. They have operated through this entire period. We did when Trump slammed the door on China, they were involved in their Chinese New Year celebration, which goes on for like a month over there. And so this happened at about the same time, but the factories were operating before and they're operating after. Now, the shortages that they're talking about are because China stopped shipping critical items like face masks, for example, to the United States. In fact, there were some ships that were laden and actually on the way to the United States, and the Chinese government ordered them to return. So it's not that they're not producing the products like pharmaceuticals, etc. It's just that they're returning them to China to be used there. And, there's really a lot of false reporting. Now, I did this investigation myself, making contact with people there that I have contacts with. And that's the information that I have available. The Chinese factories did not shut down. They just stopped sending critical items to the United States. But it does bring up the point that Trump has been saying all along, that we cannot be dependent on foreign production for critical items. And, you know, it's just really true. World and international trade is a fact of life. It's something that's very important. And you have to recognize it has to be a balance of trade, something that we didn't have before. It was raping our country from the inside out. And it was just destroying the United States. If it wouldn't have been for Trump, there would be no United States as we know it today. So anyway, that's the situation. Just a quick mention, Ford is bringing back electric cargo van production to the United States. So that's interesting because Rivian is now building, I don't know how many thousands and thousands of electric delivery vans for Amazon Prime. And they're starting to produce these now. But anyway, that's very interesting that a lot of electrical car production, vehicle production is coming back to the United States. But as I said before, there's no electricity to power this. We're not building new nuclear power plants. The rise in production of electricity due to natural gas is simply offsetting the lack of production from coal as they drop off coal production, and the alternative energy industry of solar and three-blade wind turbines will never in a million years even produce a fraction of the amount of energy that we use, and it's unreliable. So at any rate, where's the energy going to come from for electric cars, electric vans, etc.? So that's something, and of course, you all know that I'm working on this in the background. You know what I'm doing. I'm not even going to say the name because you already know. Just if people are interested in the wing generator, just want to remind you that we have the 2 to 10 kilowatt versions for farm and ranch. They can go up to 50 kilowatt, the same size that I used in the Water Abundance X Prize, one of two finalists in that competition. and also received the Technology Innovation Achievement Award from XPRIZE in 2018 for that system, the 50 kilowatt wing generator powering my atmospheric water generators, which are all professionally produced. So anyway, but what I realized once I started marketing the wing generator is that most people want something between 2 and 10 kilowatts. And that's 10 kilowatts is a lot of power, unless you're on a ranch or, you know, doing a lot of welding, things like that. So anyway, if you're interested in that, or you know somebody on a farm or ranch or out in the middle of nowhere that wants independent power, then off-grid, then have them go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. That's jmccsci.com, 7 letters. And there's an email address you can write there. Just put wing in the subject line and write a few lines, and we'll get back to you on negotiating putting a wing generator at their location, at your location. Okay, so that's it. I'm going to talk about the Spanish flu of 1918. Now, this is relevant because at the time, of course, there were no vaccinations for anything. And so the Spanish flu hit at the same time as World War I was going on. And then these deplorable conditions that the soldiers were in, and then moving troops all around the world, guaranteed that there were just, 50 million people dead, something like that, amazing number of people. This was a horrific virus where people died within 12 hours of being infected. They would come in contact with somebody, and the only place that really survived well was San Francisco, interestingly enough, because the mayor took the advice of the medical community and he quarantined the city of San Francisco, required people to wear masks, didn't allow traffic to come in or out, and basically San Francisco was saved the worldwide plaguedemic, of which is known as the Spanish flu. And apparently it's called the Spanish flu because early in the cycle it got into Spain and was killed a lot of people in Spain. So anyway, I'll be talking about that here, and very interesting when you compare it to what's going on today. But first, I'm going to talk a little bit about just the statistics of the spread of a communicable disease. It could be anything. It could be the flu. It could be any other kind of disease. And the issue is latency period, the amount of time that you can be giving this thing off while you're infected, but you don't show symptoms yet. It's called the latency period. And the strange thing about the novel coronavirus thing that's going around today is that it has like up to 10 days, in some cases possibly up to 28 days, that people can be giving this off and they don't even know they have it. And that's why quarantine is such an important issue, and keeping those people away. It's not a racist issue. It's just that this thing came from China. If it came from Somalia, then it would be you would be limiting traffic from Somalia. It has nothing to do with racism or branding. If it came from England, you would be doing the same thing. The other issue is that once a person has it, what kind of symptoms? And, you know, I've heard this, a lot of people say this, that, so many more people die from the flu, the common flu every year. And typically young people and old people who don't have a good immune system built up yet, and which, by the way, is another good reason for maintaining your immune system. And what breaks down your immune system? Being bombarded by chemicals. Cancer is related also to a weak immune system. So allegedly, we all have cancer cells in us all the time, but they can start growing when the immune system is weakened. But that's another issue. Cancer is another topic that talk about a boatload of disinformation coming from both the medical industry and the non-medical industry. Good grief. But maintaining a healthy immune system is key to staying healthy. And there's in the United States, when you're bombarded with chemicals, it's very difficult to maintain a strong immune system. And that's, like I said, I had all the communicable diseases when I was little. The measles, mumps, chickenpox, everything I had. And so maybe that's why I'm so healthy today, because I had those. And then I should be immune to those. Also, women who have those as child also can pass that on to a degree to their children, that healthy immune system, although babies are born without any immune system at all. But some of that programming propensity to have a strong immune system comes from the mother. Okay, so at any rate, back to the statistics of passing off a virus. In the Spanish flu case, people would get it. They would come in contact with somebody that had it, and 12 hours later, they were dead. There were all kinds of strange symptoms, like I won't even go into all of them. They're pretty gross, actually. But people literally would be dead in 12 hours. And so in houses, and they say that there wasn't a family or household that was not affected by the Spanish flu back in 1918. And of course, with World War I breaking out and the troop movement around the world, it just guaranteed that it got to every place. And then people would be transported, like troops would be transported on a train, and every train stop they would get out, and the people would mill around and talk to them, and they dropped the virus off in every little town that they stopped in. So it just spread, and people were just not aware. And then, of course, there were those who lived through it and probably got sick but recovered. So that's another thing, is we all talk about the consequences, or the most severe consequences, which is death. But a lot of people actually lived through this. And, you know, who knows? The end result is this. Were they better off for living through this? Did they have a better immune system that maybe helped them in later life? Or that's the other issue with vaccinations, besides all of the adjunctives that they add to the vaccinations, like mercury and aluminum and other things that are very bad for you, is that do they really create an immune system in the vaccinated kids having up to 16 vaccinations now for a kid? 16 vaccinations. And they want to start this when babies are little. You know, the world got to where it was for, you know, millennium without vaccination. So the question is, how did the human race survive before vaccinations? And the answer is quarantine. Quarantine was used throughout the ages to separate people during the Black Plague. The Black Plague came in when the Eastern hordes from China and from Mongolia and those groups came into Eastern Europe and dumped off basically the Black Plague. And of course, it was spread by flies or with rats. And there was a cycle there that promoted the Black Plague, which they, by the way, is growing now in Los Angeles. People are afraid in San Francisco and Los Angeles with the people living on the street, and the same thing as the Middle Ages, the basically human waste on the streets, that there is a potential for Black Plague to spring up again in the United States because of the homeless situation, primarily in California. That's what happens with liberal policies. I don't want to go there. But back to the statistics of giving off communicable diseases. If one person, let's do this. Let's take this one person coming in from China, if Trump had not closed the door. One person comes in from China and say there was a president in the office who didn't do anything. Say, oh, no, it'd be racist to try and put up barriers. That one person, okay, would come into an airport, potentially, let's say, conservatively, could hand it off to 10 other people. Those people are going on other airplanes. Okay, you get a person on an airplane that can hand it off to a couple hundred people, and they're all going to different places. Those people got on other airplanes. They start handing it off. Within a day or two, that one person coming in from China could potentially, because they're traveling, they're in public transportation, potentially could hand it off to hundreds of thousands of people within a couple days. That's how fast this thing could travel. And then once it's at that point, I knew that in China, for example, once they started announcing that they had 10,000 cases, that's the point at which it's already beyond the point of no return. So you have to quarantine immediately. The other thing you do in a quarantine is you examine where these people have been. Because the question is, someone gave it to them. And that someone is still walking around giving it to other people because they have not been identified. And the person that now has been identified has been walking around giving it off. And now here's another interesting twist to this that I guarantee you have not heard on the majority of at least mainstream radio or television, is that the tests that they are using are not definitive. In fact, I've heard a lot of people, interviews with medical specialists, etc., on radio and on television, and they never ask about the tests that they're giving to identify someone with the coronavirus or somebody who has died from it. Okay, so now you have a person who's sick with the coronavirus and they die. The question is, and it's a very serious question, did they die from the coronavirus? And the other question is, did the test that shows they have the coronavirus actually test for the coronavirus, or did they test for some side effect? And this happens a lot. This, for example, people are misdiagnosed all the time with cancer, especially men with prostate cancer, women with breast cancer. They are misdiagnosed all of the time because of secondary test results. They're test results that they're looking at something else, some other test, and say a level of some reading of some hormone or something like that in your body. And they go, oh, this is an indicator. And in the medical business, every one of those surgeries is another boat payment for a doctor. And so this is big business. And they're, okay, so I'm not going to go there. But the question is, are the tests that are being conducted, first of all, accurate? For example, when the first test came out for the coronavirus, they would give the test two or three times to somebody and it would come back negative and then it would come back positive, the third or fourth or fifth time. So do the tests really work? Do they give a high percentage of accurate results when they're given? Do they give false positives? In other words, they say somebody has the coronavirus and they didn't. And they take that person off and then they quarantine them. But, so you have people potentially walking around with the virus that are not being screened, that the test is not giving a positive result. And so they're walking around thinking they're okay. And then you have the other ones who think they've got it, but don't. And so in the milieu of the health the health departments and the health centers trying to sort through this, are they really giving you accurate information? And this comes down to statistics, because no test is 100% accurate. The only accurate test would be if they actually took a blood sample and said, this person is laden with coronavirus and it's overcome the person's immune system, and that's why they're very sick, or that's why they're dying. The other thing is that apparently from the reports that I've heard from people who have the coronavirus is that it's really a wicked thing. I mean, the people are coughing, and that's the main issue. It's a respiratory issue. And it's when people talk about, oh, it's just like the flu. No, it's not just like the flu. This is from the best that I can determine, in my opinion, which I'll say I've said on the air before, is this is a military-grade virus. It came out of a laboratory. And it's designed to very quickly infect a population or a troop population and render them useless in very short order. Because if all your people are sitting around coughing, they're not going to be very good soldiers. So at any rate, that's why it's kind of like a last defense against somebody being attacked by a land army, and your only defense is to let out this horrendous virus that neutralizes this impinging army, the one that you're trying to stop. And this is like a line of last defense, supposedly. I don't think it's a very good idea, because once the enemy has it, if you're engaging with the enemy, then all of your troops are going to get it also, and it's going to neutralize your own troops. So biological warfare is not a very good idea. In fact, it was outlawed by the Geneva Convention after World War I, after nerve gas, all of those other wonderful warfare devices and items were basically made illegal. Imagine that, passing laws against certain types of warfare, and especially warfare that affects the civilian population. In other words, you can send armies out, and they can fight, but there's a limitation on what you can do to civilians. But of course, that's been brushed aside over and over again throughout history. But back to the Spanish flu, the statistics of looking at what happened with the Spanish flu is that the people got it like right away. The latency period was almost non-existent, just a few hours. And the transmittal was nearly 100%. In other words, if you were in a room with somebody coughing with the Spanish flu, you were going to get it, and there was a high percentage probability that you were going to either die or come very close to dying from it, from a number of symptoms, including respiratory, including vision, including losing your balance, including skin problems. The list of things that, like I say, I don't even want to go into that. But the whole issue with the Spanish flu was that you got it right now, and the symptoms occurred right now. So are we to believe that there was some kind of biological warfare going on in 1918? Well, no. I'm not sure of anybody who would believe that that was somehow a man-made virus. I've never heard anybody say that. I certainly would not say it. And it's anything that I've ever studied on the Spanish flu never suggested that there was some kind of man-made element. There are theories on how it got started, and you can read those all day long, but they're strictly speculation. And so it's really not well known where it got going or where the initial outbreak occurred. But it traveled around the world in very short order, and that's why it's very important. By the way, the Chinese government quarantined their people. And really, that's the only thing you can do. It's called lockdown. You just shut everything down and just wait. You just wait until you see who's got it. Okay, now anybody that's been around those people, you have to quarantine and let them ride through the entire time, possibly isolate them so they get proper medical care. And in a lot of these cases, it's really difficult to tell what they even can give people. At the beginning of the show, I talked about some old treatments for malaria, and I'm sure people are trying to use almost any kind of treatment just to see what works. And once again, in medicine, it's a trial and error. You give them two spoons full of this, didn't work. You know, like there's a bad joke about the witch doctor. You know, the witch doctor comes in and does something to the patient, and the patient dies, and he makes a note. This didn't work, you know. And really, modern medicine is no different. It's a trial and error proposition. It's really no different. So, but it's instructive to look at other pandemics like the Spanish flu and see what happened when they did not have proper quarantine, they did not have proper facilities, how fast it spread, and how devastating the death tolls were at that time. And this virus could have similar effects, but it's you know, people talk about the flu. Well, no, the flu is one thing. It's a different type of virus. But getting the novel coronavirus, which is it's a military-grade virus. You don't want it. Believe me, you don't want it. And I think everybody should be very thankful that Trump slammed the door on China when he did. He said, okay, that's it. He didn't do it himself. He took advice from his medical advisors. He said, what's going to happen if we do not call a quarantine on traffic from China right now? And the end result was, this is going to be very bad very soon. And he said, okay, that's it. It's cut off all transportation coming in from China. And so he did it based on the advice of the medical community. And there again, quarantine is historically the best and truly only way to deal with something like this. One last issue I'll mention here regarding the coronavirus is business travel. Now, it looks like the airlines are going to take major setbacks this year because business travel, it's the way business is done around the world. People go places, they have business meetings, there's conferences, there are every type of exposition, etc. And I was just going to be in one myself. And the day before everybody was supposed to go and take part in this, the people in charge canceled it. Because you have people flying in from all around the world, coming through airports all around the world, meeting in closed confined areas. I mean, it's a big area. It's like a convention area. But still, people are milling around, and all it would take is one person to bring in something like a virus like that and spread it around, and then all of these people would potentially, hundreds if not a high percentage of the people could end up getting this and then taking it back on airplanes going through all of the different airports, etc., going back to where they came from. And so this could, like I say, this is the example I said about one person coming in from China. Comes into an airport, gets on an airplane, distributes the virus amongst a few hundred people on an airplane. All those people go off onto different airplanes. They go home, give it to their kids. Kids go to school. Mom goes to the church meeting. You know, before you know it, it's just like wildfire. So it was very necessary, and quarantine is literally the only way to deal with this. You have to prevent the sources from mixing in the population. That's simply the way it is. So anyway, but that is going to affect the economy. The airline industry is a major portion of our overall economy. It's huge. And, of course, all the business is that is going on But it brings up the other point, is that with this in place now, will this change the face of business meetings, where people will meet by video conferencing instead of everybody flying to a place to meet in person? And of course, I've been to countless expositions and conferences in my lifetime, and there's nothing like being there and seeing the people walking around and talking to them, etc. But with the fear that somebody could bring something in and pass it around, clearly it's going to be a while till the people are comfortable with going to, especially international meetings, where you have people coming in from all over, or business meetings. I believe that people will be doing a lot more teleconferencing in the near future, which, in a sense, I'm at the point where if I travel someplace, even for a couple of days, I lose a week. A number of days preparing, a number of days flying or transportation or whatever. And then on the other side, the same. And then when you get back, your mailbox is full and your email box is full. And, it takes a while to recover and just get back to normal. So there's a cost in traveling around and attending meetings. So at any rate, okay, well, I'll jump on to a few other topics dealing with outer space. It turns out that SpaceX is, I got a kick out of Elon Musk's comment that he thinks the Space Force could bring about an era like Star Trek. And, that's, I would say that's a fair assessment of what could potentially happen with the putting a militarizing outer space. I was just watching one of the old Saturday Night Live skits of with John Belushi and Chevy Chase and those people. But they did a Star Trek skit. And it was, a typical Saturday night. That's when Saturday Night Live was funny. And they played on themes, but the Star Trek itself or Star Wars, based on militarism in outer space, I talk about this in my Diamond Principle book. I talk about the concept that if you militarize outer space, then something very interesting happens, because now you're militarizing in three dimensions. And if you look at two-dimensional militarization of the world, there has never been a successful campaign to militarize the entire world, although a lot of people have tried. Genghis Khan, people like Xerxes, remember Xerxes? It was out to basically rule the world. Genghis Khan, how about Hitler? All of these met the Roman Empire, just to name a few. And the same thing always happens. You start out and you start out at your border. So you get out and the first date goes good. You go out, you take over other countries, and you can look at any one of these and the same thing happened. Okay, so as you go to other countries, the old style was that you then had to live off that country's food, and you took the soldiers from that country and made them your own soldiers. So that's how you grew your army. And okay, now you go out and you go to the borders of all of those countries that you captured and converted and subdued or whatever, and you go out to the next level. Okay, now you've made inroads there, and you go out to the next level. Okay, so now you're hitting boundaries. You're hitting, look at England and the United States. They were trying to fight a war across the ocean, send supplies and soldiers, etc. And a relatively small band of people in the United States that were relatively ill-equipped defended the United States against the entire British, because once they got here with their boats, they had to unload and then march across the countryside. And eventually, it just wore them down. It took a tremendous amount of resources. And so when you, and now this is two-dimensional, the surface of the Earth is a three-dimensional object, but the surface of the Earth is two-dimensional. So once you get out to a certain level, then it becomes unwieldy. It becomes very difficult to continue going out. With the Roman Empire, once they got up to the Black Forest, the Northern Europeans who were well settled in the Black Forest, etc., it was an impenetrable obstacle for the Roman Empire. And the Northern Europeans were able to finally defeat the Romans and keep pushing them back. The Romans had a very difficult time invading England. It took them 1,000 years before they actually were able to infiltrate England. And they never really got up to the Nordic countries because they just faded out. And of course, the Senate in Rome, they were making big money off of this war machine and the goods and the natural materials, the raw materials were coming in from the frontier, but they never realized that their ability to keep moving that frontier out farther and farther was collapsing. And so that's in two dimensions. Now, outer space, you're moving in three dimensions. You got to go out, and now you got to send all of your stuff from planet Earth, so it's a tremendous drain of resources. And now let's compare this to a guy or a country that says, we're not going to militarize. We're going to go out into outer space, we're going to explore, we're going to spend all our resources on exploring and getting resources in outer space, and we're going to go farther and faster. And because those other countries over there, like the United States, are putting all their resources into outer space. Remember Star Wars with Ronald Reagan? And this was the effort to break the Soviet Union. That's what finally broke the Soviet Union, because they were going out and collecting eggs and anything they could find to support their space program to try and keep up with the good old United States. And Reagan just about broke the United States also, developing weapon systems. Most of them didn't work. Most of them went by the wayside, but at extreme expense to the people, the population of the United States. Okay, so now we're going to embark on a three-dimensional militarization of outer space. Not a good idea. Not a good idea. Because there's nothing out there. We're the people that have gone the farthest, the fastest. And the Chinese are going to be much farther, much better equipped to conquer outer space than we will, because they're putting most of their effort into search and discovery types of missions. Also, the Chinese have realized something about outer space, is that you use what are called kinetic energy weapons. It's like a shotgun, but in outer space. You could have bolts or any kind of jagged metal objects. There's not a spacecraft known to man that can resist pieces of steel coming in at 20,000 miles an hour. And it's just going to take whatever it is and just rip it to shreds. So defending against this kind of offensive weapon, they call it defensive, you know, you're going to quibble over that. But the point is that destroying your enemy's equipment in outer space is a relatively simple operation. And pretty much anybody that has the ability to get into outer space and get into orbit can produce offensive weapons that destroy in a heartbeat the satellite systems, communication systems. And if you're dependent on telecommunications based on satellites, then it's a relatively simple operation to obliterate that. And that country it's an Achilles heel, because that country is not going to have the wherewithal to replace that on short notice. For example, our GPS, 5G that's going in all around the world, hundreds and hundreds of satellites going up for 5G service. It would be a relatively simple operation to destroy all of this satellite activity in a single afternoon, rendering the U.S. completely defenseless because all of our technology depends on GPS, etc. So how do you defend against that? Well, the answer is it's very difficult. Do you build a shield? Do you put up lead? No. You know, these satellites are up there, in a sense, naked. There's really no protection for them from these basically very simple kinetic weapons. And a strategically planned set of launches from a country like China or Russia or India or even a small country that has a very minor space presence, like, say, Pakistan, could take out one of the major players like the United States in an afternoon. So, and you know, you can develop all of the laser weapons you want or all the high-tech, you know, missiles, etc. But it's very difficult to defend against these very cheap kinetic energy weapons. And then the flip side is you have put all of your eggs in one basket as far as communication, as far as organizing and managing operations for your military on the ground even. So one thing Trump is trying to do is bring back the troops from all of these countries because he realizes the vast amount of resources, that including military resources, the machines, burning up the machines. That's one thing not many people talk about is the Iraq wars and the Afghan war, etc. The, you know, we're using up our valuable military equipment to bomb rocks. Not a very good strategic plan, not a very economical plan. Okay, so anyway, as far as the Space Force is concerned, I don't think it's a very good idea. I think it'd be much better to have a space exploration force that goes out and establishes where the mines are, where the resources are. But remember that outer space is for everybody, and what's going on right now is that countries are out there going after the resources. And eventually, will there be wars over this? I don't know where it's going. But the Space Force has gives me a pause to ask some very serious questions. And I don't think those people have the answers, including the final price tag. So anyway, got a couple seconds left of this show. Remember, go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. And by the way, I do sell ultraviolet water filters. They're under the whole house water filter section. You can buy those. You can put them in your water line down where the water comes into your house. Once again, the webpage, jmccsci.com. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.